From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Noel.
Our colleague Matt Frederick is still on adventures. He sends his regards. He will be returning soon. They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codename Doc Holliday Jackson. More importantly, you are you. You are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's our listener mail episode, and this one's going to be a little bit different. If you heard our strange news episode, Matt was able to somehow get back on the grid for a second and send us a story that he wanted us to share. Hope we did right by him. And in this episode, Noel, you and I have each brought a story of our own, or a piece of correspondence, but we're also probably at some point, just in Matt's honor, we're going to read out some social posts that we found interesting or amusing, or in one case, immensely relieving, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and those will be coming from our Facebook group. Here's where it gets crazy. You too can get crazy on Facebook with us. The Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, guys. All you got to do is look up Here's Where It Gets Crazy and answer a couple of basic questions just to let us know that you actually know what the show is, and then you're in. And there's a world of great content on that page and a lot of great folks and great moderators, by the way. Shout out to the mods of Here's Where It Gets Crazy. But yeah, I don't think we've really done too many of these listener mails from the Facebook group. So this will be a good opportunity to mine that for some golden nuggets.
Yes, agreed. You know, we always say that the most important part of this show is you, specifically you and our fellow listeners. Right. We're pointing at the screen.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
So today we wanted to pick up with just a couple of things that were of interest here. We've been getting a lot of feedback about our exploration of faith healing and the science behind the placebo effect, whether it can work for good, whether it can work for ill, how much efficacy does it actually have? How much impact can the placebo of any given type, a sugar pill or whatever, how much can it have on the human body? And this inspired our fellow listener, Claire, to write in. Claire, you said, "Hi, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, guys. I just listened to your episode on placebos and was curious as to whether people can suffer side effects from a placebo. For example, nausea, if they believe the medication they're taking can cause this. Thanks, Claire." This is interesting. This is something we didn't really talk about. We talked a little bit about the, you know, what's sometimes called the nocebo. Mm-hmm. And we talked about how the mind is such a powerful part of the body that it is, you know, it is possible. There are proven cases of curses basically working because somebody believed that they had been cursed. But the question about side effects is pretty fascinating because we know that placebos have a measurable effect. We know that a placebo is not going to be a one-to-one substitute for, you know, actual medicine. But we didn't talk about the idea of a side effect. So, like, imagine, just to set the scene, imagine you have some kind of condition where you need to get a shot from a doctor. And the shot you're given is actually a placebo, but they don't tell you it's a placebo. Instead, they give you the rundown of the various possible side effects of this medication. You might have dizziness.
Like writ large on the side of the bottle, or not to mention that rundown they do in those really creepy TV ads for medications where it gives you like 50 different things, sometimes including like violent diarrhea and death.
Right, right, right. And that's all happening while you see a slow motion thing of a couple frolicking in the park or someone just like laughing at salad. I've ruined so many stock photos for people now because now that you have that image of a person by themselves laughing at salad, you are going to see it everywhere. It's like a trope. But well, yeah,
I mean,
you're right.
Salad is objectively hilarious, Ben. I mean, the fact that it's still even a thing, it blows my mind. No, I'm kidding. Salad's great, but there is something that funny looking about it. Like, I could see how it could tickle somebody in a weird pharmaceutical ad, you know, especially if they're being directed to laugh at salad.
Especially if they're on whatever crazy medication they're on. I mean, the honest tagline for salad is salad. It's like cooking. I'm kidding. Salad is, it's a different rabbit hole. But one note on the point you're bringing up here for pharmaceutical ads, a lot of people in the U.S. don't know those are illegal in most other countries. Mm-hmm. It is illegal to have those kind of vague pharmaceutical ads with something that doesn't have a real name, but it sounds like it, like it sounds smooth. It sounds like it's a helpful thing, like good Butrin, right? Or
yeah, well, yeah, there's a real one. I mean, there's well Butrin.
Exactly.
I love good Butrin. Then there's like things like Celexa. It just makes it makes me feel like I'm part of a select group when I'm on Celexa, like I'm in the in crowd. Or Lunesta makes me think like I'm gonna take a relaxing voyage to the moon. You know, pharmaceutically at least.
Or Lyrica. Which might as well be the name of a superhero with some kind of song power in the MCU. But yes, sorry, I'm getting us a little off topic here, Claire. But your question is wonderful because we have a clear, consistent, like definitive answer. Yes, placebos can cause side effects. Part of that may be due entirely to the power of suggestion. Like we said, the doctor gives you a shot, you believe it to be medicine, and the doctor describes the side effects of an actual medicine to you, then your mind can play tricks on you, or your body can exhibit some of those side effects. It's what's happening is similar to hypnosis. We're not saying that these doctors or medical professionals are in any way purposely messing with you, but because of the connection between the brain and the body, if you truly believe you're receiving a treatment, then your body will react accordingly. So if you take some kind of placebo medication and you are warned that it will give you usually things like headaches, chills, nausea, maybe vertigo, depression, sleep disorders, even IBS, stuff like that, a placebo can do those things to you. It's proven. This also, yes, for the Sith Lords in the audience today, first, as always, thanks for coming. But for the Sith Lords in the audience today, yes, this does mean that if you are a very unethical person, there is a way to mind prank your friends. You know, mind freak, is that was the Chris Angel thing?
Oh, yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah, there's a way to mind freak your friends into exhibiting these symptoms by making them think you gave them an actual medicine. Do not do it. That's not what friends do. But I was surprised by this. It made me go back and think about any moments that I or maybe you have experienced something like a placebo effect. I mean, Noel, have you ever knowingly had a placebo?
Well, no, and it's actually I'm being quiet because I'm actually reading through this report on Medical News Today about a study that came out in October of last year, and it's this study that showed that medical research papers often do a poor job of describing the effects of placebos in these studies, and oftentimes placebos themselves have side effects. So essentially, if they're underreporting, or like they're saying, okay, so the whole deal with a clinical study like this is if the placebo outperforms the drug being tested, then the drug is not effective. Or that's a very cut and dry way of looking at it. But apparently, according to the study, some of the things they do to placebos include adding chemicals to make it taste more like or even feel like the active ingredient in the drug. So I think a lot of times people think a placebo is just like a sugar pill or like a saline solution of some kind. But in fact, in some of these studies, they actually do have medicinal properties. So that's a little bit off the topic, but it's interesting. And it came up when I was looking for placebo side effects. That was mm-hmm. that was an article that came up, and you can read that for yourself in a article written by Tim Newman on October 1st of 2019. For Medical News Today. But I don't know that I have been. I've certainly never participated in a clinical trial or a drug study of any kind. But, you know, backing up to the listener's original question, can you feel side effects based on placebos? The answer is, based on this report that I'm seeing, A, yes, you can. Because sometimes the placebos themselves have side effects that are similar to the side effects of the actual active drug, and that's done by design. But when we're talking about the power of the mind, if you think that a drug is going to produce nausea or headaches, you're more likely to manifest those things if you believe that those negative things could come from taking that drug. In the same way, the nocebo effect kind of describes the ability to manifest negative results from suggestion. I highly recommend a British murder mystery procedural called Wire in the Blood that is just really great and grisly and a really fantastic series in general. But there's an episode called Nocebo that specifically revolves around voodoo rituals and blood sacrifices. And I don't want to spoil it, but it's the name is gives a lot away. It's this idea that oftentimes belief enters into whether those things manifest or not. And that ends up being exactly what happens in the episode. But it ends up going a little deeper than that, more into what we're talking about here exactly. So check out Nocebo from Wire in the Blood if you've got BBC, or maybe it's on YouTube or something.
It's somewhere on the internet. This also gives you an opportunity to introduce a word of the day, psychoneuroimmunology. All one word, no spaces. Studying the direct effect of brain activity on the immune system specifically. And without having a full grasp of the science involved, we see some fascinating implications on the placebo effect here. And also to your point about the lack of accurate measurement of the placebo effect in many clinical trials and other studies, this is something that the Academy, capital A, is aware of, but we're not sure exactly how to combat it. We know that we don't have a full understanding of the side effects of placebos, whether by design or whether through action of the individual patient's mind. And we know that it's hard to fully understand that problem if we don't fully understand how this stuff is being measured in the first place. And that's where we run into ethics. How much can you mess with someone's mind, a human being's mind? And how many deleterious or unpleasant physiological things can you make them do to themselves before you violate laws of ethics? It's a weird question.
Well, sure. It's like, does the whole physician's mantra of do no harm also apply to, you know, researchers and clinical trial operators? I mean, they're scientists, but are they physicians? Like, I don't know. This is, maybe I'm asking a dumb question, but, you know, certainly when you enter into a trial of some kind, especially if it's something experimental, you are signing some kind of waiver that indemnifies, you know, those that are doing the experimentation on you from any, you know, responsibility for what happens to you, I guess. I mean, I know that's not entirely, I'm probably oversimplifying that a little bit, but yeah, you're right. I mean, if you're monkeying with people's perceptions, and especially if it comes to things like clinical trials for cancer, or maybe you enter into, as someone who is suffering from a disease, into a clinical study to try out some kind of experimental cancer treatment. That's a thing we hear about. Oh, I got my mother into a study. Oh, I got my sick aunt into a study. And then what if they get the placebo? You know, like how does that? That just seems very cruel in a lot of ways.
Agreed. Agreed. And there's one last point before we move on to our next piece of mail. This may interest you, Claire, as well as all of our other fellow listeners who have been exploring the placebo effect. The placebo, like a placebo treatment, doesn't just have the capability to create side effects. This strange phenomenon extends a bit further. People can experience withdrawal from placebos. We have to remember, addiction can be just as much a mental condition as a medical condition. So while it may seem strange that something with no active ingredient could cause side effects, we have to remember it can also cause withdrawal. You can be taking a pill that does nothing for years and years and years, and then you will feel horrific and horrid after you are no longer prescribed that placebo. So there's power there.
Yeah, it makes me think of that recent Safdie Brothers movie with Adam Sandler, which is fantastic, but also like literally you're signing yourself up for a cinematic panic attack if you watch this movie. But I have personally seen it about three times. But there's a character sort of based on a real basketball player and played by the basketball player himself, Kevin Garnett, who gets obsessed with this uncut gem, this opal, and he borrows it from Adam Sandler's character, who runs this this gem shop in the Diamond District in New York City. And he believes that it will imbue him with powers to make him play better. And he does play better. So it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy. And then when he doesn't have the gem, he plays poorly because he's like addicted to this sense of whatever this thing does for him. And it's the same with gamblers, you know, and that's a big part of the movie too, where they have to have a certain, you know, lucky coin or like a whatever pair of socks or something, or, you know, they make a bet in a certain way or bet the same numbers or whatever. Like all of these things, you call them superstitions, but there's power in these things. You give them meaning and then they become meaningful to your brain.
Right. And this leads us to so many other paths. It's something that we should do an episode on fully in the future. It reminds me of Kurdecha, which I may be mispronouncing, K-U-R-D-A-I-T-C-H-A. It's a name for a kind of shaman in an Aboriginal group in Australia. And from this practice, we have examples of what could arguably be called the fatal placebo effect. So check it out if you're interested, but you can also sit tight because we will do an episode on that in the future, hopefully soon, because I've got to justify how many weird things I've been reading about this. So thank you very much, Claire, and everybody wrote in on that regard. And now we're going to pause for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be back. And we have returned. So, Noel, this is one that really stood out to you. And I think it's an excellent question. You and I talked a little bit about this off air earlier. I don't remember how much earlier. It could have been like yesterday, could have been the 1800s. I have no idea now.
Unclear, dude. Time is lost its luster and pretty much all of its meaning in our lives these days. Yeah, no, we were talking about the Screaming Girls of Malaysia episode, which I think was one that stuck with all of us a bit because it combines a lot of the elements. It actually combines the idea of a placebo effect even could be wrapped up in that topic, where there's this power of belief and seeing somebody else experience something and feeling that as though you may be experiencing it yourself. These young women in the public schools in Malaysia, it's happened several times, have been stricken with these fits of screaming and seeing apparitions and almost like a sense of possession. And then we dug a little deeper and realized that these parts of, what is it called, Ben? Peninsular Malaysia? They're a little more rural. Mm-hmm. It's the most religious parts of the country, a country that's already pretty religious. And so there's a sense of that power of belief just being particularly strong in this part of the country. But we did kind of bring up briefly how they had some similarities to the Salem witch trials, where individuals were essentially accused of witchcraft, put on trial and killed as a result of some young women acting as though they had been possessed and speaking very specifically about seeing certain things. And there are themes in that story where you can see it dramatically in the Crucible, the play. But a lot of it ended up being like, oh, these girls were colluding in some way, or they sort of saw each other behaving in certain ways and started kind of like copycatting a little bit. And that was one of our theories maybe about what was going on with the Screaming Girls of Malaysia. But in historically speaking, something that comes up surrounding the Salem witch trials is the notion of environmental contamination. Okay, mm-hmm. We're going to get a little deeper in that, but first I'm going to read this email from Tanisha. Hello, I just finished listening to the Screaming Girls of Malaysia episode, and I'm really surprised that possible environmental toxicity wasn't mentioned. Surely outside investigators have tested the drinking water, air pollution, and soil, and I would love to hear about it. I thought you were going to bring it up after you mentioned the witch trials, because I know that a common modern theory is that people were having hallucinations due to, this is said to be the drinking water here in the email. Anywho, thanks for putting out a great show, Tanisha from right here in Atlanta. And this is an interesting thing, because it's definitely not something that I don't believe this is a definitive answer, Ben, to what caused the witch panic, the satanic panic.
Yeah, ergotism, right?
Ergotism. And that wouldn't have been water. It would have been, maybe so, it was something in corn, right? Isn't it something that breaks down and becomes almost a hallucinogenic substance? Or it's a plague of sorts that can affect crops, I thought. But
yeah, it's a fungus. So there's right. a nod to it in one of the best horror films that came out recently, The Witch, mm-hmm. where the produce is contaminated. It can cause a condition called ergotoxicosis. Really what's happening is people are ingesting the alkaloids produced by this fungus, which is called Claviceps purpurea. Not the best name. It infects rye and other cereals, and it can cause things like convulsive seizures and spasms, diarrhea, and it can cause mania, psychosis. It can also cause a really gross kind of dry gangrene.
Mm.
It's been proposed that something like that could partially explain the outbreak of mass hysteria in Salem at that time. But I would also, I would draw attention to the idea of St. Anthony's fire. This was probably ergot poisoning. That's the theory where it seems much more likely than the speculation for Salem. So St. Anthony's fire is called that today because it was named after monks at the Order of St. Anthony. They were considered to be very successful at treating this kind of gangrenous poison, which would cause... It would just cause pandemonium. I mean, imagine you're already tripping balls, basically.
Right. Yeah,
and
yeah.
then you see other people who are afflicted, but their physical bodies are changing. Like they're seizing up, arms are swelling or freezing.
Right. Yeah. And the young girls that I mentioned, Betty Paris and Abigail Williams, were the sort of patient zero, I guess, of the Salem witch explosion, this kind of like massive spate of witchcraft accusations. And they were exhibiting symptoms very similar to that. They had convulsions and, essentially reporting having visions of sorts. And you're not kidding, Ben, when you say this stuff makes you trip balls. It actually is fascinating the way this stuff works. It can infect rye, the grain that you grow, that you can make bread out of. The way it works is this fungus, this ergot fungus, can grow and actually replace these shoots of grain from these ryes. For lack of a better way of, I am clearly not a farmer. Grass, okay, thank
grass.
You. There you go. With something called scurlotia. And scurlotia is a persistent, according to the Britannica, a persistent vegetative resting spore of a certain fungi. So it's essentially it's dark in color. It can vary in size, and sometimes it can get up to 4 inches in length. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely the science behind this infestation. And there's another great article in Britannica that talks about the whole potential for this ergot poisoning in the Salem witch trials, it forms typically after a severe winter and a particularly damp spring. Mm-hmm. And this whole theory was put forth in 1976 by Dr. Linda Caporale of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and found quite a bit of evidence that this could very well have been what happened, that this was a case of contaminated rye that would have been, you know, made into all kinds of foodstuffs, including bread.
Yeah, there are some issues. You're right. 1976, that's the first serious proposal we have about this theory. In 1982, another historian, Mary Matossian, talks about this as well in an article in American Scientist. There are a couple issues. Before we get to Malaysia, I promise you, we're on the way to Malaysia here. Before we get there, one of the issues with the Salem witch trial, for as far as this explanation goes, is that ergot poisoning has additional symptoms that were not recorded in Salem, right? In some of this stuff, we know that it can cause mental breaks and it can have these cognitive effects, but more people would have been affected by ergot poisoning from what we understand. It would be likely, at least, that more people in the town would be affected and that they would exhibit some more of those physiological symptoms of ergot poisoning. That's not to say this didn't happen. It's just to say that there would be additional symptoms and that the number of children who were afflicted, because we have to remember a lot of the, like Salem, we're talking about children. There were fewer of them that would have been affected in any other ergot poisoning epidemic that we know of. And this this does put us in a great spot to ask about Malaysia too, because this is something I was wondering when we were prepping this episode, you know, different ways to explain this. We spend a lot of time in the episode, for anyone who hasn't heard it yet, exploring the sociocultural lens through which people experience these things. And then we don't spend, you're right, we don't spend very much time talking about possible environmental contamination and what it could be. So it's not rye bread, that's for sure. But it could be ergot transported through some other sort of vehicle, some other sort of carrier. But reading about pollution in Malaysia,
exactly,
we find that it does have a very high level of air pollution. It's unfortunately not uncommon these days, but that would appear to have impact on things like the lungs and the heart more so than mental function.
That's right. I will say, though, I did find, this is a little over my head, but I found a report on contaminants and the soil environment in Malaysia from Y.M. Kanif and S. Salmija from a larger paper called Contaminants and the Soil Environment in the Australasia Pacific Region. And there is an abstract. We're talking about how Malaysia's, you know, undergoing a lot of very quick development and rapid industrialization. And agriculture is a big part of that. And, you know, there's a lot of very fast growth in the agriculture sector. And along with that comes increases in urban populations and creations of new urban areas. And along with that, you know, sometimes industry outpaces, what's the word, Ben? Oversight or regulation, right? And so there is a list of contaminants in the soil of Malaysia. And there's a particularly interesting column that talks about peninsular Malaysia. And it does appear that it does contain some pretty high levels of some contaminants. It's divided into several regions, peninsular Malaysia, Sabah, and Sarawak. And I did notice that in some of these categories, the number for peninsular Malaysia was a good bit higher even than some of the other regions. Some of the specific contaminants that are listed, I am not familiar with, and they're certainly not household names. So I would definitely want to do some more digging into that. Mm-hmm. But it does have to do with things that are specifically found in the soil and that could be considered contaminants. So, and then I found an article in looking into this about how contaminants, well, maybe don't make you trip or, you know, have some kind of like psychotic episode. Just basic environmental contaminants can have an effect on your mental health and just your like well-being. Lead. Absolutely, Ben.
Yeah, I want to say also in support of the point you're making, we looked into drinking water in Kelantan as well, because it seemed like that would be a good place to start. Like that would be one of the most ubiquitous common vehicles of transporting a contaminant would be the air, the water, or as you said, the soil. And I didn't find evidence of a hallucinogenic agent, but we do know, to the fantastic point you just raised there, Noel, something doesn't have to immediately make somebody mentally unstable for it to have a long-term cognitive effect. This is where we introduce something that may be familiar to our fellow listeners. As a matter of fact, some of us may be listening to this conversation and saying, I can't believe they're not going to talk about lead contamination and crime. This is related, if only tangentially. There is a long-running proposed link between elevated blood levels in children as they're developing and increased rates of crime later in life. We know the facts about lead. It's toxic. It's dangerous to multiple organs, in the brain especially. And individuals who are exposed to lead at young ages do seem to be more vulnerable to learning disabilities, decreased IQ, ADHD, lifelong problems with impulse control. So now there are experts who are proposing that lead contamination may have a possible long-term effect on various communities. There's still, you can see how that research gets complicated and very sticky very quickly. You'll see other studies contradicting it. But one of the reasons I think the question about environmental contamination in this case of the Screaming Girls in Malaysia is such a good question is exactly that. We do not understand the long-term effects of these. We don't understand the long-term effects of these contaminants. We could say with reasonable certitude that it's probably not ergot poisoning specifically because of the way people were affected and the length of time they were affected or when they recovered, etc. But we simply cannot rule out some possibility of an environmental contaminant. That's where I'm at least. What do you think?
I'm with you, Ben, and I want to just double back really quickly. The study that I mentioned at the top of the show, it was very in-depth and dealt with a lot of different types of, you know, acidity and different soils and stuff. So I don't want to couch that as evidence that necessarily that Peninsular Malaysia has higher rates of contamination than the rest of the country. But I will say I did find an article that does say that Malaysia has significant water pollution problems, and that does stem from that rapid industrialization that I talked about that study referenced. I mean, that holds true. But it points out that Malaysia doesn't actually release individual values of river water quality measurements for monitoring sites. It just releases it kind of on a spectrum of three rankings: clean, slightly polluted, and polluted, but won't really give you a breakdown of what materials are in the drinking water. So I think this is something that we probably owe it to ourselves and the listener to maybe revisit another time. But I do think that you're right, Ben. This is not something we can absolutely rule out.
Agreed on all counts here. And thank you for raising this important point, Tanisha. Also, I believe that you are a fellow Georgian. So it's great to hear from the hometown crew here as well. This is something that we are going to have to spend some time exploring. So I don't know what anybody else was planning for this weekend, but don't invite me to your parties, because I am going to be reading a lot about environmental contamination in different parts of the world. And let's see if we can find something there. In the meantime, we're going to pause for a word from our sponsor, and then we'll return with our, our very first Matt Frederick tribute segment. Okay.
And we're back with the first ever semi-annual, hopefully, I don't want him to be gone too much. We miss you, Matt. Matt Frederick Appreciation Corner, wherein we also make this a listener and a Facebook group member appreciation corner, because we're going to pull a couple of comments from our Here's Where It Gets Crazy Facebook group, which you too can be a part of. Just go to facebook.com and search for Here's Where It Gets Crazy, and you can be part of the fun too and maybe end up on one of these. But you know what? I think it's not fair to only do this when Matt's gone. We should probably figure out a way to incorporate this in a little more regularly. And I've got one. I think that's been on a lot of people's feeds. What's up with this UFO in Jersey? You hear about this this Jersey UFO?
Oh, just a little bit. What's going on with it?
I mean, you know, look, it's I don't want to like let the wind out of the sails too quickly, but there were a ton of reports originally on TikTok Monday of the week that we're recording this. But yeah, there were a lot of reports flying around the internet this week, starting with TikTok user handle at Baby Jenny, who posted a video of a pretty cool, legit looking UFO hovering over New Jersey's Route 21. There were other people looking at it from the side of the road with their phones up, you know, and just kind of slack jawed. And like I said, the way the video pans very quickly, it's kind of a whip pan situation. You just kind of catch a glimpse of it, but it really does look like a broad daylight little saucer situation, just kind of hovering in space up there in the Jersey sky. And the video got 4 million views, more than 600,000 likes in just a day. And then the truth came out, as it tends to do. You know, it's always on the table that a thing like that hovering slowly could be a blimp. But we heard the truth from none other than a representative from Goodyear, the blimp people.
Yep. Now I know this story.
Yeah, the blimp people. They called into Insider and said, hey, we were flying a new blimp in New York that day in northern New Jersey on Monday to capture aerial footage of the NFL game between the Pittsburgh Steelers and the New York Giants at the MetLife Stadium, which I'm assuming was populated by little cardboard cutouts of people. Mm-hmm. Have you seen those photographs of baseball? Mm-hmm. There's one that was in the Bay Area where it was like, you know, this insane Blade Runner sky, like just like, you know, desert kind of sepia colored because of these wildfires. And then all of these really haunting cardboard cutout people sitting in the stands watching the baseball game.
I'll do one crazier.
Yeah.
In South Korea, a company populated a stadium with sex dolls. And then they said they were just life mannequins.
Okay.
Did a story, Strange News Daily, on that one. What I think happened is that they wanted to buy mannequins, and they got a good deal, and they didn't do enough research to figure out that these are clearly sex toys in the stands. But, you know, everybody is trying to make it work. Also, shout out to Goodyear if you're listening. A number of years ago, I got very close to getting a ride on one of those blimps. It's a dream of mine. It's actually kind of exclusive. You have to get invited. Did you know that? Like, you can't buy a ticket.
I wouldn't imagine that you could, but it's also not like the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile that just sort of rolls around to different places and you can go in and check it out. Definitely a little harder to get up to that Goodyear blimp. And, you know, can you imagine, where do you park a blimp? Do you moor a blimp? Do you have to dry dock it? Do you sort of like tie it up, and or do you deflate it and then just inflate it every time you're going to use it? That's what you do? Okay.
Well, there's a rope that hangs down at all times, and there's a person in the ground who is in charge of that aspect. And so it's like, if you're in a blimp crew, you know, some days of the week you get to fly the blimp. Other days you have to be the person holding the rope. God. It's like
an elaborate inflatable kite. It goes up. Yeah. But I will say, the thing that's remarkable about the video, though, and you can literally hear people aghast, just saying, oh my God, just having their minds blown. It's got this little blinking light on the bottom of it that like is very bright, and it's right in the middle of it, and it has the appearance of the thing at the bottom of the classic sci-fi UFO that beams people up, you know, that shoots up that wide swath of blue light, and then you get caught up in the tractor beam and pulled up to presumably have things done to your butt. So I think that might have been what did it, because it also looks very symmetrical, and I typically think of a blimp as being tapered, you know, like fat on one end on the front end and a little tapered on the back, but it really does look like a flying saucer. And so I could see how it would have freaked some people out. And even when Goodyear chimed in, that people weren't having it, they thought that was fake news and continued proliferating this stuff on Twitter and Facebook. And I think finally now people are coming to terms with the fact that this was in fact a blimp and not a UFO.
Yeah, but given all the research and the revelations about state-level monitoring of UFOs, we know that something freaky is happening in the skies. I'm referring to the U.S. program, but I'm also referring to Japan, which it turns out may have been investigating UFOs for some time as well. Matt, if you are listening to this, I went through these things and I was looking for some stuff that would be interesting to you, but also looking for some stuff that might give you a chuckle. So here's one that I thought would be interesting. This is the kind of thing that, from Matt's perspective, I would imagine Matt being very, very into exploring. And that is that the FBI has warned doorbell cameras like Ring can give an early warning of police searches. You saw this too, right?
No. Tell me more about it, and I'll look it up and follow along, but this is news to me.
Yeah, so this came through a leaked FBI bulletin, and we found out about this courtesy of Joe B. on Here's Where It Gets Crazy. Essentially, the FBI didn't mean this to be public knowledge, but they said, ironically, the rise of the surveillance state is letting residents of a home that has a Ring camera or something like that, it's letting them get a heads up if law enforcement is showing to conduct a search, which is kind of ironic given that the concern of a mass surveillance state is always being vulnerable to some kind of search, right? Or some lack of privacy. This reminds me of Waze. I used to love the GPS app Waze,
yeah.
And it did something that really irritated law enforcement when it would let you know if there was a speed trap ahead and you could warn other people.
Well, sure. There's even a little icon on Waze specifically for like a cop car. It's a little animated police car that shows up on your map. And then you get the prompt, which isn't entirely the safest thing in the world, whether to confirm or deny that that's still there. So it's sort of crowdsourced information about where these law enforcement officials are posted up. I don't know, Ben, don't you think it's sort of our prerogative to get an early warning if law enforcement are at our door, especially considering things like what happened to Breonna Taylor and all these unlawful no-knock warrants and, you know, problems with the way warrants are served and people getting killed? I mean, I don't know. This seems like a non-issue to me. I feel like I want to know and be prepared.
Right. I mean, consider the murder of Katherine Johnston, who was 92 years old. When she was killed by police in her home here in Atlanta, Georgia. The real issue here is private service versus a public entity, right? Because Amazon is already blurring the lines with this. We know that they have aggressively marketed themselves to local police departments. And on March 17th, 2016, the CEO of Ring, one Jamie Siminoff, sent out an email with the subject line, "Going to War." And they said their new mission is to use consumer electronics to fight crime in closer and closer participation with public law enforcement. So the line is being blurred. Technology is disrupting the line between private and public entities. And I think that's the heart of the concern. If I was the kind of person to own a Ring or something like that, and it somehow didn't tell me when certain people were at the door, then in my opinion, it's a broken service. I shouldn't use it. I should get a refund. So that's one thing I thought would interest you, Matt.
It is interesting. I wanted to point out one thing from my my experience. I used to live in a place, two places before where I currently live, that when I checked it out, somebody pointed out to me that it probably used to be a drug house or perhaps a manufacturing house because there was a pretty conspicuous camera mount on the top of the roof, kind of, that was like, and I don't know, maybe that was jumping to conclusions, but I understand that's almost like it does have sort of a reputation of like, oh, if you have a camera like that, you're trying to protect yourself from the cops, or you're trying to get an early warning signal or something like that, which is interesting to me, given the age of the Internet of Things and us wanting to have literally a camera in our fridge. Like, I feel like that's sort of an outdated opinion, but it is something that somebody pointed out to me. Is like, oh, see that camera? This place obviously used to be a drug house.
I don't know. That's like if you have a beeper, you're either a doctor or a drug dealer, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's,
or it's
that's
1994. Yeah.
I think still.
But, okay.
But I wanted to find on a lighter note something that I thought would give everyone a chuckle. That's a shout out to Owen D., who posted the following statement. Nothing has felt the same since I learned that goats have accents and can't understand other goats from foreign countries because their accents are different. I got to tell you, I've lost track of all the times I was in a place where people didn't speak English as the primary language, and I tried to like pet a dog or say hello to some other animal, and it looked at me like I was an idiot, because I was, because I don't speak, you know, K'iche or something.
Sure. Yeah, I've always been fascinated by the idea of animals having different flavors of noise-making sounds in different countries. But typically, I think it's usually relegated to just like the onomatopoeia version of it that you read in fiction, like a chicken in Germany, I think, says kikeriki, you know, whereas over here it says cockadoodle-doo. It's all just how it hits your ear. You know, I don't think the actual animals have different accents, but who am I to say?
I don't know. I think they do. I choose to believe that they do.
Okay.
Based on very little proof. So let's see. I went twice in a row. Noel, you got one to round out the day for us?
Just a quick one from Bob P. On the Facebook group. He posted a delightful meme. It says, news reporter, can you tell America why the Amish haven't been affected by coronavirus? And it's an image of a woman interviewing an Amish gentleman with his back turned to the camera. And then the Amish gentleman says, because we don't have television. There's a lot wrapped up in that. I just love it. It's just, I don't know. There's a lot to unpack there, which I just love. Oof. It's just, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, on that note, thank you. Thank you to Owen. Thank you to Joe. Thank you to Tanisha. Thank you to Claire. Thank you to everyone who has written in and helped make this week's segment of Listener Mail possible. I would massively appreciate it. If you want to be part of the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. As we've said, you can visit us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Check out our Facebook page. Here's Where It Gets Crazy. You can also find us as individuals on the internet.
You may find me on Instagram exclusively, if you wish, at HowNowNoelBrown.
And you can find me on Twitter at BenBolinHSW. You can find me on Instagram at Ben. I don't know why I emphasized it like that. It's just another social media site. You can find me on Instagram at BenBolin. If you hate social media, you can give us a phone call. We're 1-833-STDWYTK. You probably know the rules by now. 3 minutes, tell us the truth. Get as weird as you want. Just let us know if you're okay with us using it on the air.
If you don't want to do any of that, you can just get in touch with us the good old-fashioned way by sending a nice old-school email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.